Alvin and Lawrence, you Bell are here, the Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York, also known on our show as the gurus of how-to. They visit us once a month to talk about various matters, include and throw out a quiz, and take your calls. And our number here is 212-433-9692. Have I left anything out?
We'll try not to burn down any houses. You know, it's funny, every time I'm listening to a pop radio station and that comes up, I go, am I on this show?
There's a lot of gurus of how-tos out there.
It's nice to have your own theme song.
It actually is. It's strange when it comes on the radio and I hear it and I go, do I start talking now?
This is an interesting time of year, and we've seen it with the recent weather variations.
Mm-hmm.
They say March comes in like a lion, goes out like a lamb, but March seems to be coming in like a lion and a lamb, and then
back to
who
a lion.
Knows what'll happen.
It's a strange month. I don't know whether this has to do with the global warming or something that is going on, or it just happens to be happenstance, and we happen to be in that particular period.
Well, we've had other Marches like this. And yes. Matter of fact, I remember snow at the end of March.
Yeah. I remember during the early 80s, April 1st was an amazing snowstorm. So we get
and that was
kind
spring
of,
already.
Yeah, yes. So we get that kind of weather around here. But I think the thing that people have to be careful about, which I was actually, this was actually fits into what you're saying. On Saturday, I was actually doing an inspection in Carroll Gardens, and I'm sitting there in the car waiting for the appointment to start. And all of a sudden, I mean, Saturday was beautiful. Saturday and Sunday were 55, 60. I think Sunday got up to 70 degrees. And I see people ripping down their plastic, you know, those temporary storm windows we talk about, you know, the film that they put, and they're ripping them down. And I'm going, what are you doing? We still have 2 or 3 more weeks of actually weather that's going to be below 55, 60 degrees, wishful thinking, but we're still heating our houses, and now they've actually ripped that off. So for that period of time, yes, we're not probably going to get much more 20 degree weather, but still, anytime the interior of your building is warmer than the outside, heat is actually going to be leaving your house, and I think that was a mistake. I was almost looking at these people going, what are you doing? It's not over yet.
But the only march that I know about is the March on Washington, March on Albany, March. That's the marching that I get involved in.
We're going to give you marching orders if you don't shut up.
Which is so ironic because when I think of March, I think of my birthday. So,
Is there anything else you want to tell us before we go into the quiz and then start taking some of the questions from our listeners?
No. Well, actually, the thing is that we're talking about is we come across this conflict of interest and soft costs versus hard costs costs when you are about to fix something in your house or go through and get some construction done, and people don't really know, because everybody is more or less a layperson when it comes to construction and repair, and I always felt it would be a good story just to talk about. How do you choose, and what is the procedure?
I think the first thing we need to talk about, the difference between hard costs in construction and soft costs in construction. Hard costs are the materials you put into the building and the labor it takes to put it in. That's your hard cost. Your soft costs are all your design, consulting, supervision work, which oversees the work. And there is a theory.
Well, there's a third side to that, and that is what the designer says you need for the hard costs.
Right.
Because we've gotten a lot of calls from listeners who have said, you know, somebody came to my house and told me I need to rip up this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And you've said, well, in some cases you've said it sounded like it was probably the best solution. In other cases you've said, well, you know, it sounds like somebody's trying to make a lot of money.
Well, that is the problem. To understand the conflicts of interest and be understanding of what is really going on.
But let me finish with one thought. Usually speaking, when you bring down your when you spend a little bit more on soft costs, you're able to bring down your hard costs. And hard costs are traditionally more expensive than your soft costs. But people have a hard time justifying spending money on just consulting.
because they can't open up the door and say, look what my consultant said.
And you're right about that, is that one of the things that we're talking about here, about having consultants and having advisors, is are they able to think outside the box? Are they able to look? A lot of times designers, architects, engineers tend to look at things in a very linear way of the way they would think. And other architects and engineers and consultants think things totally differently.
Well, the thing is, to paint an analogy, the thing is that I come across a job that we had to get involved in where there was a leak underneath a palatial lobby where they had this finished stone floor. And the plumber said, let's cut a hole right through this floor and put in a brand new pipe. That's where the leak was. And then I came onto the job and I said, that floor costs more than the whole plumbing job if you had to repair it. He says, let's reroute the heating system in such a way that we'll go around the floor instead of going under the floor. And that literally saved my client tens of thousands of dollars. So you really have to say, I was part of the soft course. But sometimes contractors will only look at something that's simple for them or something that is more costly, and they will make more money from it. So you really have to be very careful.
Or the way they know how to do it, because that's where they've been doing it over the years.
And that's exactly right, too.
And we've also said the problem is a lot of times rely on their vendors as their consultants, and that's also a problem.
Yes.
Now, when you come by, we throw out a quiz for our audience to solve. And sometimes they can, and sometimes they can't.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds,
eventually they do, by the way.
This one sounds hard.
And you have a picture.
I have the answer in front of me, and I'm still not sure I understand it. Can I ask the question?
Go ahead.
Sure. You seem to like that.
It's my favorite part of the show. Because you get to answer all the questions, unless it's about squeaky stairs, you know. Otherwise,
you're pretty much a spectator.
Go ahead.
The question is: what is the construction term that describes the device that is used to place concrete underwater? That's really interesting.
Yes, mm-hmm. And the placement of concrete underwater has been going on for hundreds of years.
Well, since I think they've developed concrete.
Yes, they were. And
when did they develop concrete? Back in the Egyptians, and then the Greeks and the Romans really went crazy on it.
Our number here is 212-433.
I have no idea what it is.
I'm fighting a cold.
I finally remembered the last one.
212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. My guests are the gurus of how to, Alvin and Lawrence U. Bell. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. Before we go to the first call, a lot of people have been writing in, and I thought I would just read one of them.
Uh-oh.
Joe in Bergen County left a question on our show page. As happens about once a year, my bathtub and bathroom sink are stuffed. Before I pour down the liquid plumber gel, I'd like the U-Bell's opinion on that. In the past, I've used drain doctors who've charged plenty and created additional problems, such as causing the big sink at my garage to back up.
Well, generally speaking, when there is a blockage in a particular configuration of plumbing, in most instances, it's a bad plumbing design to begin with. The pipe sizes are probably maybe too small for what you're using in them for, and whoever designed it or put it together probably didn't calculate how much usage you're going to get. The other thing is that sometimes you put something down the toilet bowl or you put something into the sink that really doesn't belong in the sink. The other thing is that some people will put in a garbage disposal unit into their kitchen sink that the kitchen sink tailpiece and the pipe that runs down into the drain is not large enough to accommodate a garbage disposal. So these are the things that do take place, and sometimes you really need a consultant rather than a plumber, or maybe a plumber will tell you what to do, but it's too costly to do it.
The other thing that I'm thinking is also the fact that we don't know how old this person's house is, but I found in my house, which is a 1930s house, that a lot of the older pipes have reduced their opening inside because of a buildup of debris on the inside. You really can't clean those things out. They build up, and hair and grease are probably the worst things. So what used to be my kitchen pipe, which was 2.5 inches, I actually had to pull out this whole section of pipe. That two-inch pipe was actually reduced down to less than an inch now. And then once I put in the garbage disposal, it stopped working. So I had to actually replace a whole section of pipe. Well, any building that's over 40 or 50 years old, some of the pipes, I know this is like horrible to say, are going to need replacement, especially the narrower pipes, the sink pipes, the tub pipes. And that might be what's required here.
Let's go to one of our callers, Susanna from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Susanna.
Once a week, I have to drain my boiler, or at least that's what I was told to do. I have radiant heat, and I'm wondering if I can reuse that water in my garden or if it's toxic.
Well, first of all, you have a hot water system?
Yes.
And they're telling you to drain the water?
Once a week, I was told to take bucket of water out of it.
Maybe actually, well, I'm thinking...
Depends on what device it is. Some of them do. But the thing is, do you mean to drain out all of the water?
No, one bucket.
One bucketful.
But it sounds like a steam system, not a hot water, because...
Okay.
But it's, you know, I would actually, what I'd like to do, which I've done with a couple of listeners, if you want to, I can actually have this conversation more if I know more, which is take a couple of pictures of your boiler from a bunch of different angles, and you can email them to me at larry@accuratebuilding.com. I'll look at it. I'll give you a call. I'll see what I think is going on there. As far as the question of reusing the water in the garden...
Mm-hmm.
What do you?
No, because it has a lot of sediment, and sometimes some plumbers have put chemicals into the water.
That's true too.
In order to retard leakages, and also it has a lot of iron oxide and the copper sulfate sometimes, and this could hurt some of the plants in your garden. I would get rid of that kind of water.
Dump it down the drain.
Yeah. Water from a coffee pot or tea and something like that. That's a vegetable, and that wouldn't hurt the coffee. Wouldn't hurt the grass or the plants. But something inside of a boiler, I would think that it's gonna hurt plants.
In fact, coffee grinds are good for compost.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Excellent.
Yes.
Let's take another call. Laurie from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I have an exposed brick wall that I want to paint. It needs some prep and repair.
Mm-hmm.
I need to fill in a lot of missing mortar. I'd like to know if pre-mixed mortar can be expected to pretty much match the texture of the original.
Well, you can actually, if what I would do is probably not, it's not going to match the texture, but you can probably make it to match the texture by adding addition. If it's smoother than what's there, you could add more sand to it.
Okay.
Or what happens is, actually, as Larry said, it will never match as far as color is concerned, but texture can be achieved. If it is a rough texture and you put this ready-mixed mortar mix inside and then go over with a wire brush or some other kind of brush, or if it's very smooth, you can go over with just a plain ordinary spoon, an old plastic spoon, and make it nice and smooth. So there are a lot of different things. It really takes a technician who has done this many, many times. To do it yourself, you'd have to practice once in a corner where nobody sees it and then achieve the effect that you want.
Okay. Also, there's always a constant fall of, fine grit and
dust.
Sand. Will the paint seal that?
Yeah, well, the paint will seal that. I would not use a latex paint on concrete or cement or bricks. If you want to really seal it up and it's on the interior, I would use something which would be polyurethane type of paint or an alkyd type of paint, and this would prevent that powdery substance from coming off the brick and the mortar.
Thank you for calling us, Laurie. Mm-hmm. Let me read another one from one of our listeners. This one left this question on our show page. How do I safely remove a bathroom mirror from the wall? It is just a plain mirror, but I can't tell what adhesive is holding it there.
That is a thing that happens when we, in department stores, we take mirrors and we put them up with what they call a mirror mastic, which is a black gooky kind of stuff. And when that solidifies, it is almost impossible to remove. The way we used to remove the mirrors is with a hammer. We just break the mirror, tear it all down, be careful, wear goggles, wear gloves, clean it all up with a vacuum cleaner, and then put and
so
then
you can't
clean
save
up the
mirror.
It is impossible. Now, I don't know whether somebody may be saying successful, but what's going to happen is when you pull it off, if it's with mirror mastic, it's going to pull off the silvering that's on the backside that makes the glass the mirror that it is. Mm-hmm. And so that's I don't think there's the labor and work that you have to put in to remove a mirror in one piece. It's not worth it.
But one of the things you might want to try is if you can get a flat piece of metal, you could probably, if you can get behind it and start tapping it and get between the mirror and the mastic, you might be able to take it down. But once you start to put any stress on that mirror, it's going to crack anyway. It's very difficult to get them off.
Paula from Manhattan, how you're on the air.
What's up?
Hello, thank you very much. I know you talk about insulation all the time.
Yes.
But could you be specific, a little more specific about all the different kinds of insulation that there are and more products coming?
There are the two most common, which is fiberglass and rock wool. Fiberglass is probably by far the most common and made by probably at least a dozen manufacturers, at least in this country alone. Usually marketed by Owens Corning or by CertainTeed or by a couple of other companies that don't come to mind right now.
Johns Manville. John
Mansville. They are big manufacturers of this type of material. And it's probably the easiest to work with because it already comes in bats or blankets so that you can roll out. And some of it already has vapor barriers. Well, actually, all of it has vapor barriers on it, and you can buy it with or without vapor barrier. What they also take is that same fiberglass or rock wool, and you can actually have it as a blown-in insulation, and that's also common. We like both of those kinds of insulation because they're non-flammable. They will not support combustion.
The other type of insulation is probably vermiculite, which is a loose kind of material which they use in plants and things like that, but
right.
you can actually pour them down inside of cavities of the building. But they do settle in after a while, and you have to add more to it after a while. The insulation types that I dislike for the interior of a building is styrofoam and also cellulose. The cellulose is really paper, which is treated with copper sulfate and some salt materials and things like that. And they have a tendency, if it is not treated properly and overly treated, actually corrodes away the nails and the pipes within the building.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as styrofoam is concerned, if it isn't something that – most styrofoams are not fireproof. And also, if they do catch fire or they're have a lot of heat next to them, they give off toxic fumes. So those are the things that I'm afraid of.
In addition, there's also a lot more expanding foams, which is good for sealing different areas or installing it where you have a minimal, where you're only using a small amount of it. But we also are very concerned, which they were having the problems when we used to have urea formaldehyde, of a lot of this insulation outgassing, and outgassing gases that are very toxic and carcinogenic to us. So we're kind of concerned about that. Some of the new foams tend to be a little better, but they do all tend to outgas a little, and you want to read up on each one and whatever particular sensitivities you might have. But the bottom line is fiberglass and rock wool and vermiculite are probably your safest choices.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
And we have an intrepid listener who thinks that he knows the answer to our quiz, which is, what is the construction term that describes the device that's used to place concrete underwater? Kevin from Fairfield, what do you think it is?
Cofferdam.
No, yeah. A cofferdam is actually what you would do if you had to keep the water away. But this device, actually you can pour the concrete right through the water, and it actually forms underneath the water. Actually, you might actually construct a cofferdam around this to put it into, but this is not the cofferdam.
And this enables the concrete to displace the water. As you put the concrete in very carefully with this device, it actually pushes the water out and the concrete takes its place.
So we will take a little break, and maybe some other people will take a chance and call in with a suggested question, answer to the question. Our number here is 212-433-9692. My guests are the gurus of How To, Alvin and Lawrence Ubell. Stay with us.
Mr. Fix-It. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mr. Fix-It. Mr. Fix-It. Oh, yeah.
You know, you might want to check out our video section where you can take a peek inside our studios. And as I talk with guests like Costa Garvis, Lynn Nottage, and Mikhail Baryshnikov, click on video pics on our show page at WNYC.org. We've gone to TV. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with the Gurus of How To. We haven't been gone that long, just a few moments. But the Gurus of How To are here to answer your questions about home repair and related matters, 212-433-9692. Let me
just say, that song I don't hear as often on the radio.
That was a big hit in the 80s, I think.
Really?
Yeah. Mary in the Bronx left a question on our show page. She says, nearly flat roof needs replacement this spring, and we'd like to be able to have a garden up there. We would like to know how we can find someone knowledgeable about green roofs who can advise us on the best materials and contractor. And is it possible to find a roofer who will let us do some of the work, such as removing the old roof, which is essential this time, ourselves with supervision?
I have a lot to say about this. The most important is, The roof that's on the building right now is designed for a certain amount of dead load and a certain amount of live load. And that live load can be, you know, the snow and the rain and the ice and everything that's supposed to be imposed upon it, bearing the fact that it's in this part of the world in this climate. But as far as which it may be necessary to put a green roof up there, you might have to reinforce this roof, which will probably require getting building permits and architectural drawings and engineering design criteria. The second thing I want to say about green roofs, I think they're a great idea, but you as the consumer have to make yourself more knowledgeable. The other day I was at the New York Botanical Gardens, and by the way, they had a great the orchid show was wonderful. But at that point I was looking through the book section at the gift shop, and they had a bunch of books on green roofs. And I do recommend that before you go down this road of spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to make this green roof, you need to know something, because this is a new frontier that we're getting involved with, and not everyone knows. A lot of people, a lot of contractors say, oh yeah, I know all about green roofs. Well, what do they really know? Do they know as much as you do? So you really need to – by making yourself knowledgeable, you'll know the key words that they will say or not say in order to show that they actually have knowledge of this kind of technology.
So what happens if the roof isn't structurally sound
enough? Well, it depends on the building that it's built around.
It depends upon the load that you're putting in. You have to understand the dead load is that which the building is built out of, and it has to support itself. And the live load is whatever you impose upon it. And when you impose something on an existing structure, you're actually increasing the dead load but decreasing the live load. That means the live load is what you are. Your people, your furniture, or whatever you're going to work on it. So the idea is that people, and we have seen this many times, they increase the dead load so much that the roof becomes dangerous. So that's why you need to have an architect or an engineer evaluate what you're about to get yourself into. It is really,
really
critical. And you want to know something. If you don't do it that way and something does happen, the insurance company may not pay off. So you got to be very careful what you're doing.
I just want to say something about green roofs. Is that like I said, they're a great idea, a great way to retain a lot of the water, so our sewer systems are not overwhelmed, and that's part of the thrust by the municipalities to get people to do them. But if just think about it, pick up one potted plant and see how much that weighs. Now multiply that by your entire roof, and then add water and the plants in. So also, it's a tremendous amount of weight, and people have to really be understanding of that concept.
Yeah, I had a job where they had a concrete building, and they made a green roof. They put about maybe 6 inches of topsoil on the concrete work, and they think it was going to be great. And it rained, and the roof broke. The concrete broke.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine, the water came rushing through, and it flooded out the whole area. So you got to be very careful to what you're doing.
Okay?
Okay. Iris from Jamaica. Hi, you're on the air.
Jamaica.
Iris, are you there?
Iris?
Iris?
Okay.
We lost her.
Iris, it was nice not talking to you. Alan from New Jersey.
We'll not talk again soon.
Alan from New Jersey thinks he knows the answer.
Alan,
let's hear it.
I do think I know the answer. It's called grout. It's non-hardening, and they used it when they built the bathtub at the original World Trade Center site.
No, that's not what we're looking, for.
Well, let me read this to you once again. What is the construction term that describes the device that is used to place concrete underwater?
Okay.
In other words, we're looking for the device, not the material.
And the hint is that it's tube-like.
Yes. I understand.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
You're very much welcome.
Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to try Iris one more time. And oh, not yet? Okay.
Maybe not.
My crack staff. We go now to...
Don't make fun of them. I like them.
I'm not. No. They don't want me to embarrass myself on the air. I do it anyway. Esther from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. I have a three-family house and semi-attached.
Mm-hmm.
The thermostat is... I live upstairs. The thermostat is upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we put the heat up to 70... and I cook in the kitchen, then the thermostat does not give any heat
right
to the apartments below me. So in order for them to get the heat, I have to raise the temperature.
Let me ask you a question. I know your problem. I've done more than enough inspections about this. By the way, my other big pet peeve is in co-op buildings where someone thought it was a brilliant idea to put the thermostat in the hallway where nobody lives. I think that's a great idea. I think that's a great idea, and I'm being sarcastic. Well, your problem is that your kitchen is your thermostat is in the dining room?
Yes.
And your kitchen is next to the dining room?
Correct.
You need to move your thermostat to one of the bedrooms. It's a pain. You got to get an electrician there to run new wires. But what happens is when you're cooking in the kitchen gets warm, so the thermostat thinks the house is warm. And you're artificially making it warm as opposed to the rest of the building. If you move that thermostat to one of the bedrooms, which would be not affected when you cook, that would take the real temperature. Now, this is a three-story building or two-story?
Three.
And you're on which floor? The center?
I am on the top.
On the top. Well, that's also not so good. It should be actually on the second floor, but you're not going to do that because your floor tends to be the warmest floor anyway.
Correct.
And the bottom floor tends to be the coldest.
Correct.
So it really should be in the center floor, but that's not where you live. But what you can do, and I saw this in a building I just inspected, is what they do is they put a sensor on one of the other floors, but the thermostat is in your apartment. And so the sensor, that you put the sensor in, no one knows where it is or it's not easily changeable, and then your thermostat can control that. That's where the sensor is to pick up the temperature of the house.
And also when you put the new thermostat or the new sensor, wherever it is, it has to be on an interior wall. It shouldn't be on an exterior wall.
At eye level. Okay?
At eye level.
At eye level.
And, of course, an interior wall, because an exterior wall, it's going to wind up connecting to the
outside
air outside.
Right.
Exactly.
So I'll warm up the outside rather than the inside.
That
right.
is correct.
It will take the temperature from the outside, which is always colder. Yeah, so
I'm sorry. Somebody suggested that I enlarge the pipes of the water heater, water system. Is that a smart idea?
No, because it should work fine. Let's do the cheapest thing first, and the cheapest thing is actually moving the thermostat.
Uh-huh. Way cheaper. Putting a sensor in the other apartment.
In one of the other, or just like I said, or just move your thermostat to one of the other bedrooms.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you so much.
No. Thank you, Esther.
Thank you.
Let me read another question from a listener, Jennifer from Midtown, New York, left a question on our show page. She says we have very old plaster walls with not a stud to be found. Would it be impossible for us to safely secure wall-mounted shelving?
Well, as far as wall-mounted shelving, there has to be some structural elements within the wall in order to support that wall. The sheetrock or the plaster, whatever it is secured to something.
Maybe it's on gypsum blocks or something.
Well, unless it is gypsum block. But the thing is that when you put shelving up, the lateral load of those shelves is very slight. Most of the load is perpendicular down to the floor, so just fastening it back with a bracket on the top of the shelving, you can put what is known as a ledger piece that you screw a lot of screws into it, and then you connect the top of the shelving where nobody's going to see to that ledger board that you secure, and that'll be more than adequate to laterally support the shelving that you put on. Unless you're putting up shelving with brackets that you connect to the wall itself, that takes a different technique. I hope I answered that question.
But there is a stud in there somewhere, and sometimes it takes just drilling holes horizontally until you actually find where the stud is.
There's also a thing called the stud finder that sometimes works very well, which is really a magnet.
Yeah.
I thought Match.com is how you was a stud finder. okay, let's...
we're going to leave that one alone.
Let's go to a few people who think they know the answer to the quiz.
Mm-hmm.
Fred from New Milford. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Fred.
Hi. Yeah, I'm not sure about this one because of the previous answer, but I thought caisson.
No, but that's actually very interesting. No, the caisson is what you do is in order to dig down into the soil to get your what they use for the Brooklyn Bridge to get down to bedrock,
right,
which on the Manhattan side, I think they never got to.
They never got to bedrock
on the Manhattan side.
Actually, about three people called in with caisson. I'm not going to go to all the calls,
but
that you're not alone.
Thank you.
Okay, now Andrew from Brooklyn. Is it Andrew? No, Adrian, is it?
Hello?
Hello, it's Adrian.
Adrian, they gave you an N in your, two N's in your name.
I'm sorry about that. Okay. Is it a Tremme? T-R-E-M-I-E.
However you're going to spell it, yes, it's a Tremme.
You know what that means, right? You won.
Okay.
Now, the question that we have to ask, how do you know this?
I looked it up.
In what?
I looked it up in an architectural review book.
There you go.
That's great. Very good. What a Tremme is really only it's a piece of pipe that goes all the way down to the bottom of where the cement is going to be poured, all the way down to the bottom of the water or the ocean or wherever it is, and then they very slowly pour concrete in through a funnel through this particular pipe, which is called the Tremme. This and then as the concrete pours out, they pick this Tremme up very slowly and they gently put the concrete on the bottom of the water or a dam or wherever it is, and the concrete solidifies inside the water. Because once the concrete is mixed with water, the water doesn't leave the concrete. The water becomes part of the concrete. It's really called the process of water of crystallization process.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the water on the outside does not affect the concrete that you pour into it.
Okay, so Adrian, I'm going to put you on hold, and one of my producers will take your address, and you will be receiving?
Save Money, Save Energy by Al Ubell and George Merlis.
George Merlis.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And okay. I'm so technically incompetent here. I need the gurus of how-to come in here and tell me what to do.
I'll sit on your lap next show.
Nadine from Matawan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Nadine.
Hi. This summer we had to replace our deck.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, we've had ants in the bathroom.
Hmm.
Well, it depends upon what kind of wood did you use in the deck?
Oh, they use pressure-treated wood, the whole...
But you know what I think probably happened is probably when they disturbed... You took off an old deck, and when they disturbed the ledger board might have actually had termites in it.
Ants,
ants, rather. Same difference.
No, it's not.
Anyway, the ledger board might have had ants in it or an ant infestation, and they started going all over the place. And this has been for how long you've been having this ant problem?
Since the summer, since the new deck.
So it's been already 6-7 months.
They could have disturbed the nest.
That's what I'm
they
thinking.
They could have disturbed
That's
the nest.
What I'm thinking. I would bring in a – have you brought an exterminator in?
No, I didn't want to go that route, but
– Do you have pets? You have pets?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a problem. Yeah, that's a problem. For now, I would actually try a regimen of more, environmentally friendly things like boric acid and stuff like that, which doesn't outgas all over the place, and it's not that bad for us humans and so on, but it's terrible for the ants.
Yeah, but if he's a licensed exterminator and you tell him that you have pets and stuff like that, they will use a non-caustic kind of insecticide that is specifically designed for ant infestation. And if you impress upon him about what you're about to want to achieve, I think you can be in good hands. As long as he's licensed to do chemical treatment, you're going to be okay.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
We have very little time, but I wanted to sneak Janet in. She's been hanging on for a long time. Janet, what's your question?
Oh, thank you. I was listening a few months ago, and somebody asked about windows that insulate against noise.
Yes.
You mentioned something called City Windows, and I was wondering what that is, and how do you spell it? Is that a brand name?
I think it's actually a company called City Windows here in the city. And I've seen them, and basically what they do is they install another set of windows interior of your existing windows. And what I found yesterday, I did an inspection yesterday on 6th Avenue and 58th Street, and they had just a regular set of glass storm windows, and they seemed to cut out a lot of the sound. So I would try that.
If you want to reach the U-Bells, you can write to Larry at U-Bell, U-B-E-L-L.com.
Or AccurateBuilding.com.
And we will be seeing you again on April 8th. You know, that's not all that far from now, is it?
No, it's not.
Not. Where, again, we will show all of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts how to go forth and fix, save energy, and do it safely.
And do it safely.
And do it safely. On tomorrow's show, New York Times correspondent Charlie Savage tells us about Barack Obama's view of executive power now that he is president. Then Linda Carter joins us to discuss life after Wonder Woman. And the great choreographer Paul Taylor discusses his company's new season at the New York City Center. Plus, on Underreported, the latest scientific research on why locusts swarm. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Barbara Kahn, Alex Hutz, and Ben Lansky. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.